Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, and this is Last Week in the Church. This is the show where we sort of pan for gold in the torrent of last week's news on the Vatican beat, looking to excavate, extricate, and explicate those few nuggets that you really need to know. Here's what we've got this week. We begin with holiday in Venice. Pope Francis takes his first trip out of the Vatican in 2024 over the weekend. He spends Sunday morning in the stunning and singular Italian city of Venice. We'll explain how one emotionally charged moment in particular brought home the intersection of the political and the pastoral when it comes to papacies. Second up this week, we've got the tale of a title. Pope Francis resurrects one of the traditional titles of the papacy. We will explain why, despite the Vatican's best efforts to pretend this never happened, and to tell you there is nothing to see here, this move may actually have both ecumenical and intra-Catholic significance. Third up, pro-life Parolin, the Pope's top deputy, the Vatican Secretary of State, Italian Cardinal Pietro Parolin, comes out swinging against a recent effort by the European Parliament to inscribe abortion among the fundamental rights recognized under the EU Charter. We'll unpack what he said and why it matters. Fourth this week, we've got Ahoy AI. The Vatican confirms that Pope Francis will travel to southern Italy in June to take part for the very first time in a summit of the G7 nations, and in this case, to speak on the subject of artificial intelligence. We'll try to explain what the Pope is likely to say and why this outing is of interest. And then finally this week, we've got Jousting Germans, how four of Germany's 27 bishops have announced that they are not going to continue to take part in that country's controversial synodal way and are withdrawing from efforts to build a new governing body for the Catholic Church in Germany. I would say we'll explain what that means. It's just I'm not sure we or anyone else actually can explain what it means, but we'll give it our best shot. All that and more is waiting for you on this episode of Last Week in the Church. So please, for the love of God, in the name of all the angels and saints, and in the name of St. Mark, the patron saint of Venice, go nowhere, because we will be right back. This is our official Last Week in the Church infomercial, because I come to you with a special offer for all of those would-be Catholic eggheads out there. That is, if you're the kind of person who likes sounding smart, who likes creating the impression that you know things other people don't. That certainly describes me. If that describes you, you're going to want to know about this. Now, I've already spoken about this new app, this new online resource called Magisterium AI. Basically, what it allows you to do is to type in a question like, what does it mean that the Pope is infallible? Or what does the Catholic Church teach about the environment? Or, you know, whatever. And it will give you a short, smart, easily digestible answer based on more than 5,000 official magisterial texts. But recently, these guys have created a new feature on the app. It's called the Scholarly Mode, which draws not just on official texts, but also the best and brightest of Catholic thinkers and theologians over the centuries, from Augustine and Aquinas to more contemporary figures. And we'll also give you a very quick answer about what those folks have had to say about what the Church teaches on various issues. Now, I promise you that if you try this once, you're going to wonder how in God's name you ever lived without it. It's brought to you by our friends at Longbeard. They are the digital marketing design company that provide the IT backbone for Crux. They provide the same service for a slew of other Catholic organizations and outfits. They're brilliant, and they are creative, and they are tremendous. And I'm kind of out of adjectives at this point, which is saying something, because I traffic in adjectives. But I am telling you, these people are the absolute level best. So check it out. This is Magisterium AI, their new scholarly mode. You're going to dig it. Magisterium.com, that is Magisterium.com. It comes with my personal guarantee.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Happy Tuesday to you. Happy Tuesday, April 3rd.
in the year of our Lord, 2024. This is that sort of great period in Italy every spring, where last week on Thursday, we had the national holiday, we had Liberation Day. This week, we've got the 1st of May, which is informally considered a national holiday in Italy. So lots of Italians are taking what they call a bridge that essentially amounts to 2 weeks off of work, where no one does anything, or at least they do as little as humanly possible. Nevertheless, despite the fact that my wife Elise and I are thoroughly Italianizzati, you know, we've been living in Italy much of our adult lives, we, nevertheless, are hard at work here at Last Week in the Church, bringing you the latest and greatest on the Vatican beat. We begin this week with holiday in Venice. So Sunday morning, Pope Francis boarded a helicopter and took the brief chopper ride from Rome to the northern Italian city of Venice, where he spent a little over 4 hours, basically. He visited a woman's prison where, among other things, the Vatican Pavilion, that is the Vatican exhibit, as part of a cultural festival in Venice known as the Biennale, where it's being staged this year. He then met with artists who were taking part in the Biennale, this cultural festival. He then had a session with youth in Venice and then celebrated an open-air mass in the piazza that is in front of the famed Basilica of San Marco, the Basilica of St. Mark, the legendary patron saint of the city of Venice, and also recited his Regina Caeli address before returning to Rome. Now, what's the significance of all of this? Well, let's begin with the fact that the Pope actually did it. This was his first expedition, if you like, outside the Vatican in calendar 2024. And of course, the early part of this year has been marked by a series of papal health scares. There were times when the Pope had to withdraw from high-profile public events, skipped his Palm Sunday homily, he wasn't able to do the Good Friday Via Crucis celebration. There have been other times when he's had to have people recite his public addresses because he was struggling with respiratory difficulties. And, you know, whenever an 87-year-old pope who has had a series of surgeries and maladies starts having problems, people start banging the drums that maybe the end is nigh. Well, I mean, the truth of it is, the pope we saw on Sunday would seem to be a guy who still has some gas left in the tank. He arrived in Venice. He read all of his public addresses himself. He seemed alert, engaged, enthused at every one of these events. And for all the world, you know, looked like a pope who was able to continue to keep going for a while. And we should note, this is merely the first of what is a fairly ambitious schedule for Pope Francis in 2024. In May, he's supposed to be going to Verona, as we tipped at the top of this broadcast. Now in June, he's going to be going to Puglia in southern Italy for the G7 summit. In July, he's going to be making a trip to Trieste on the border between Italy and Slovenia, my wife's homeland, by the way, so therefore of great historical and personal significance for us. And then, of course, in September, he is supposed to be making this very ambitious international journey to Indonesia and Papua New Guinea and East Timor and Singapore. Then later in September, he's supposed to be going to Belgium. And for all we know, he may be doing something else before the end of the year. And all of that is on top of the fact that he's got his culminating Synod of Bishops on Synodality here in Rome in October. So if you're asking, is this a papacy getting ready to turn out the lights? I would suggest the answer is probably no. This weekend in Venice would seem to highlight that. Now, here's another point I would like to make about the Pope's Venetian holiday. As I mentioned, probably the emotional crescendo of this event came at the very beginning. When the Pope, when he arrived in Venice, went first to a women's prison. It's actually one of only two large-scale prisons devoted exclusively to women in Italy. It's located on the island of Giudecca in Venice, one of the islands amid the lagoons there in Venice. This structure is built out of what was a 12th-century monastery. Then in the 16th century, it was turned into a home for, well, what they call here in Italy, prostitute pentite, that is, repented prostitutes, women who were trying to recover from having been women of the night. In the 19th century, it became a women's prison, which, of course, Italy being Italy, this was a women's prison, administration of which was turned over to an order of nuns, the Sisters of Charity of Venice. The mother superior of this order was also the warden of the prison, which is a job she held until 1990. It was 1990 when the Italian state finally took over administration of this prison. At the moment, there are about 80 women who are incarcerated there, many of them foreigners. It has a capacity of about 110. When Pope Francis got there, he arrived in his wheelchair, came into the little courtyard in the center of the prison. He then spent about a half hour doing a swing where he greeted absolutely every one of these 80 female inmates, in addition to the administrators and guards and everyone else who has anything to do with this prison. But he spent most of his time greeting the inmates. Then he gave a little talk in which he, you know, said, look, I know all of the problems that prisons have, but I want to say that nothing, no power on this earth can take away your dignity. And he said that we're all going to be enriched by this encounter, and nobody's going to be more enriched than I am. He talked about how important it was for him to be there. The women who were sitting there, and we were watching this on the feed in full living color, the women who were sitting there were visibly moved. Many of them were weeping. At the end of the thing, they all had another opportunity to greet the Pope because they're all involved in various activities. Some of them are seamstresses. Some of them grow flowers. Some of them make food, or some of them make beauty products. They all had the opportunity to present the Pope with samples of their wares. One of our favorite moments was when they presented the 87-year-old pontiff with a basket full of like shampoos and unguents and oils. We had a lot of fun imagining the kind of rose-petaled baths the pontiff might take in the Casa Santa Marta, utilizing some of these products. In any event, the point was, this was the Pope at his pastoral best. Now, this meeting is not going to make any news. You're not going to read about it, you know, on the front page of the New York Times or Le Monde. You're not going to see this, you know, on CNN or the CBS Nightly News. But for those 80 women who were sitting there, this was an absolute life-changing event. Now, here's the thing. Like, I'm a journalist, which means I'm as cynical as the day is long. I understand that when you put a pope in a situation like this, right, where he is in front of marginalized, excluded, desperate people, and he has a chance to be a nice guy, that has propagandistic value. I understand that, okay? In part, it's about making the pope look noble and heroic, and therefore neutering any potential criticism of him. In other words, there is a political component to moments like this, right? And let me just be very clear. The fact that Pope Francis has such a capacity to open his heart and to make connections with people who are the most vulnerable and the most marginalized in the world, such as these female inmates, that by no means means there isn't a legitimate criticism to be made of his policies on China or Ukraine or on the blessing of same-sex unions or anything else. Okay, that's all fair. But at the same time, and here's the point I really want to make, the fact that there is a legitimate debate to be had about papal policy on many fronts also does not invalidate the pastoral legitimacy of what he means to these people when he is in those moments. In other words, for those 80 women who were sitting in that courtyard of the Giudecca prison Sunday morning, the Pope was a dispenser of hope. He opened to them horizons of possibility that they had probably, many of them had believed, had up to that moment been closed. And I would say this, I don't think there is any office on earth that on a more routine basis goes around offering hope to hopeless people than the papacy. We can have debates about whether popes zig or zag, but let us not take our eyes off the prize. That at its best, that's what the papacy does. And I would suggest that the best of this papacy was on display Sunday morning at Venice's Giudecca prison. All right, second up this week, we've got the tale of a title. So I've got a visual aid this week. This thick red book. These are not the sayings of Chairman Mao, because that, of course, was his little red book. You can see this is not a little book. This is quite a thick volume. This is what the Vatican calls the annuario. It's basically the yearbook of the Vatican, in which all of its important information is contained. So I am going to open to the page in the Annuario. It's one of the opening pages, where we begin with the presentation of the Catholic hierarchy. That is, from top to bottom, everybody who's part of the Catholic hierarchy. And of course, it opens with the Pope. So here we have, on page one, Francesco, Francis, with the one title that this Pope actually cares about, Vescovo di Roma, or Bishop of Rome. Now, if you flip the page, what you will find is that, in addition to a short biographical sketch of the Pope, we also have a list of what are called his historic titles. And this is Pope Francis's way of saying, yeah, these are all titles of the papacy, but I don't really make much use of them today. On this list, you will find things such as the successor of the Prince of the Apostles, the Summum Pontifice, the Supreme Pontiff of the Universal Church, the Primate of Italy, the Metropolitan Archbishop of the Roman Province, and the Sovereign of the City-State of the Vatican, and finally, the Servant of the Servants of God. Now, prior to the, oh, by the way, this one comes from 2002, so it's not the most recent, but they're all pretty much the same. Now, prior to 2006, on that list, you would have also found the title Patriarch of the West, one of the traditional titles of the papacy. However, in 2006, Pope Benedict XVI decided to drop that title, so it, poof, disappeared. It was no longer in the Annuario. This year, in the edition of the Annuario that went on sale April 9th, 2024, poof, presto changeo, hocus pocus, the title is back. So Patriarch of the West is once again listed among the titles of the papacy. This all happened, however, with no announcement, no explanation, no comunicado, no press conference, nothing. As the Italians would say, un bel niente, an absolute vacuum from the Vatican. No attention was called to this whatsoever. So what are we to make of the fact that in 2006, this title just disappeared, and in 2024, it's back? Well, went away in 2006, there were two basic explanations that were given. One was the one that Vatican officials tried to sell. The other was the one that many people actually believed. The official explanation was that the title Patriarch of the West had outlived its usefulness, that in ancient Rome, when the empire was divided between East and West, West had a clear geographical reference, but today it no longer does. The West can mean Western Europe, it can mean Western Europe and North America, it can mean Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, and points beyond. Nobody quite knows exactly what it means, therefore it's outlived its usefulness, therefore it was dropped as a housekeeping matter. Okay, that was the explanation that the Vatican tried to give. Now, what others believe is that this was actually a power grab by the papacy, that to call the Pope the Patriarch of the West means he's not also the Patriarch of the East, or of the Middle East, or of Africa and Asia, or of every place else. In other words, it was artificially delimiting his power, and so getting rid of it, some critics saw as an assertion of global, planetary, universal, galactic, if you like, jurisdiction by the Pope. And so that controversy simmered for a while and then kind of, you know, went away. Well, so now in 2024, Pope Francis quietly and without any fanfare has decided to resurrect this title, again, with no official explanation from the Vatican. What are we to make of it? Well, what some fans of the Pope are saying is that this is an ecumenical move, because it's Francis saying, look, I only want to claim administrative control over the Western Church. As far as everything else goes, I'm open to a kind of, what, a supremacy in charity, but I don't actually have to be calling the administrative shots. In other words, it is seen as a kind of voluntary limitation of the Pope's juridical or administrative authority. And apologists for the Pope are trying to say this is a great contribution to ecumenical relations. Now, of course, if that's true, these apologists for the Pope, what they're actually saying is that in 2006, the Vatican was lying. I mean, they're saying the unofficial explanation was actually the correct one, that it was an unecumenical move at the time that has now been reversed by Pope Francis. In any event, the real question here is, How come all of this is happening in the dead of night? I mean, how come the Vatican has given no explanation, no account of this at all? They just simply printed the title in the Annuario, and that was it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I would suggest maybe it's because the people around Francis just don't want one more time when it is publicly clear that Pope Francis is overturning a decision made by his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI. They have been through that. They've been through it on the Latin Mass and several other fronts, and maybe they just simply don't have an appetite in any big public way to go through that fracas again. Doesn't change the substance of the situation, perhaps, but it may explain why they're downplaying it. In any event, bottom line here is, once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to be complete, exhaustive, and accurate about the various appellations of a pope, Patriarch of the West is back in the mix. All right, third up this week, we've got pro-life Parolin. So over the weekend, Italian Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Pope's Secretary of State, and therefore, in effect, kind of the prime minister in the Vatican system, the number two guy after the Pope, gave an interview to Avvenire, which is the official newspaper of the Italian Bishops' Conference. Avvenire means the future. And he discussed many issues, including the war between Russia and Ukraine. He said he believes that a major exchange of prisoners between Ukraine and Russia is imminent. On the war in Gaza, he said the Vatican remains available to mediate, should that be desired. But perhaps his most interesting comments came with regard to Europe and abortion. So the European Parliament, in part in response to a proposal by French President Emmanuel Macron, recently voted in fairly overwhelming fashion to include abortion among the fundamental rights that are recognized by the European Charter, the EU Charter on Fundamental Rights. The vote was actually something like 330 to 160, so it was fairly overwhelming. Now, in some ways, it was a symbolic vote because to amend the EU Charter requires not simply a vote of Parliament, but it requires the consent of all 27 member states of the European Union, and both Poland and Malta, states in which abortion is either tremendously restricted or outright illegal, both Poland and Malta have indicated they are not going to approve this change. And so, in some sense, this was a fairly hollow move, but nevertheless, it was a clear statement on behalf of a strong majority in the European Union that they would regard abortion as a fundamental human right. Now, it is perhaps not unusual that a senior Vatican official would speak out against that. But what was unusual, I think, is the fairly dramatic terms in which Cardinal Parolin did so. In this interview with Avvenire, asked about this result in Europe, he described it as a radical attack on human life, a radical attack. And he asked, how can we believe that with such a radical attack on human life, we're going to build a future? He said that, how can we think that abortion is a right? How can we think that a society can be based on a system in which human life is disregarded in such a fashion? He said that in the bottom of his heart, this result had produced what he described as a great sadness. And he concluded by saying, I don't understand. I just don't understand. Now, this is very strong language, particularly for a papal diplomat. Okay, and let's remember, Cardinal Parolin's whole career has been as a diplomat acting on behalf of the Holy See. Diplomats generally do not take public positions on contested political questions within somebody else's jurisdiction, in this case, the European Union. They certainly generally do not attack political proposals in such a dramatic fashion. And so the question poses itself, what are we to make of the strong, really remarkably strong language that Cardinal Parolin used in this instance? Well, I would suggest there are at least three plausible interpretations. One is Cardinal Parolin is well aware of the criticism that Pope Francis is a pope who has downplayed the so-called life issues, abortion, marriage, euthanasia, and so on, at the expense of social justice concerns, immigration, poverty, war and peace, the environment, and so on. And so perhaps this is an attempt by Parolin to sort of balance the scales to indicate, you know, look, we can be as serious about the life issues as anyone. Secondly, it may also be that European elections are looming this June, that is, elections for the European Parliament. This question of the place of abortion among the rights recognized by the Union is likely to be in play. And this may be a shot across the bow, in other words, a deliberate move by the Vatican to say, don't kid yourself, if you move further and faster in this direction, we are not going to sit it out. We're going to resist. Now, if you want a third, and to return to the theme of cynicism as one of the subtexts of today's broadcast, one could also say that the 69-year-old Parolin is well aware that on some short lists, he figures prominently as a candidate to be the next pope himself. He probably realizes that among more conservative members of the College of Cardinals, how outspoken the next pope would be willing to be on life issues may be something that they are concerned about. And so perhaps, in some roundabout way, this could be interpreted as him putting down a marker. Look, whether or not that was actually what was in his heart and mind, I don't know. But what I do know is that there will be many people who are sort of handicapping the papal sweepstakes who might be inclined to see this in those terms. All right, fourth up this week, we've got Poi AI. This week, Italian Prime Minister, and by the way, this is an interesting thing, that a papal trip in the first instance was announced not by the Vatican or by the local bishops or by any ecclesiastical source. It was instead announced by the Italian Prime Minister. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, in a video message, a special video that she released on social media, announced to the world that Pope Francis would be joining the G7 summit that is scheduled for the southern Italian region of Puglia on the country's Adriatic coast, which is set for June 13th through the 15th. And in particular, he's going to be addressing a session on artificial intelligence. This is a theme the Vatican has been very concerned with. A couple of years ago, the Pontifical Academy for Life pioneered what is known as the Rome Call for AI Ethics, which was signed on to at the time by high-tech giants such as Microsoft and IBM. Recently, just in the past few days, the Pope received the CEO of Cisco Systems in the United States, who also signed on to this Rome Call, the heart of which is what was referred to as algoroethics, that is a combination between algorithms and ethics. And the idea is that AI should not be simply about profit and getting rid of human jobs in favor of automation, but it should be about serving the common good. And so the Pope will be in Puglia promoting that idea. It will be the first time a pontiff has taken part in a G7 summit. And listen, let's face it, although the Pope ostensibly is going to talk about artificial intelligence, you can bet your bottom dollar that when he is in the presence of the movers and shakers of the Western world, including President Biden of the United States, he will also be talking about Russia, Ukraine, Gaza, the climate, the economy. I mean, in other words, this will be an opportunity for the Pope to push his agenda across the board. And just as a footnote, another indication that this is not a pope getting ready to wind down, ladies and gentlemen. This is a pope getting ready to ramp up. Fine. This week, we've got jousting Germans. So this week, four German bishops indicated that they are formally withdrawn from plans in their country to develop a new synodal council to govern the German church that would be made up of both laity and bishops. These four bishops, who are conservatives, are saying they're siding with the Pope, because the Vatican has said to the Germans several times, you really should not go forward with this. The Germans are going forward anyway. These four bishops, in pulling out, have said, not only are we not going to participate, but by virtue of our not participating, that means this is no longer an initiative of the entire bishops' conference. It's simply an initiative of the 23 bishops who are left. Therefore, it has no juridical validity. Therefore, it's invalid. Now, what does all this mean? Honestly, it's extremely unclear. I mean, one way of reading this would be that the German bishops are divided and that their synodal way is in crisis. Another way of reading it would be 85% of the German bishops, 23 out of 27, are still involved in the process and they're determined to go ahead, the Vatican be damned. And, you know, how this is going to play out in the future remains to be seen. Probably the raw truth of it is that the momentum in Germany towards this kind of independent, collaborative lay and episcopal method of governance, if the Vatican really wants to interrupt that or to slow it down, it's going to have to do something other than issuing appeals. It might have to start removing people from office. That, of course, would be a painful, messy, difficult undertaking. The question is, does the Vatican at the moment have the stomach for it? All I can tell you on that front is stay tuned. Obviously, we'll be following. All right, that is our show for this week. Of course, as ever, you can find full coverage of all of these stories on the Crux site. That is cruxnow.com. We will be back here, same bat time, same bat channel, 1 week from today with the latest and greatest on the Vatican beat. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, have a fantastic and blessed week, and we will talk to you again very soon.